podcast, and welcome to part two of the interview with Stuart, who spent his adolescent growing up years at the Royal Military College of Duntroon. Part one of this episode outlines his own recollection of the by now notorious practice of bastardisation. Stuart ultimately decided to resign from the college, so I begin by asking him if he had any regrets leaving Duntroon to pursue a very different career path.
No, I had no regrets. I mean, that was a question that that people used to ask me a lot, because I guess it was seen as something that was very hard to get into. So, you know, so why would you leave? But I had had absolutely no regrets. I think by the time I was 20 or 21, I'd actually wanted my life to go in a different direction. As I said, I'd met somebody, and we wanted to create our own life, rather than have a situation where essentially your life was dictated by the army, which meant that essentially you would rotate and be transferred from place to place about every 18 months.
Mm.
And we said, well, no, we want to make our own decisions about where we go in life.
Mm.
And so, as I say, I was fortunate enough to get a position with CSIRO as a graduate. They had a graduate rotation process. Now, I hadn't actually graduated at the time because I'd resigned, but they must have thought that I'd done enough, if you like. And when I went into CSIRO, because I hadn't formally completed my degree, they had a program where they would give you release to go to university. And so I transferred to ANU. And because they didn't do the same subjects, didn't have the same level of subjects as I'd been doing physics and chemistry and pure maths. And so I couldn't continue on with my physics because they didn't have that. Well, not the particular branch that I've been working in, which was to do with the fundamental nature of magnetism, if you like. And that was a bit of a thing that a professor at Duntroon was interested in. Mm. But there wasn't the same stream, if you like, at ANU. So I ended up doing computer science and applied mathematics. And so I eventually graduated from ANU, but I was given release from CSIRO to go to lectures and so forth, and that was something that was done quite a lot in those days.
Mm.
So that was a good experience. I was there for about 6 years and worked in some pretty interesting areas. I spent time at the Division of Computing Research, which in those days used to operate an Australian-wide computer network, which was, you know, as people talk about the internet now, well, in 1971 or 72 or whatever, these things still existed, but they were done in a different way.
Mm.
And so
it was a very early version of the internet.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. And so I worked in that area for a while. And then I also worked at the Division of Entomology. And one of the key things that they were doing at that time was a thing called the dung beetle program.
Mm.
Because if people remember back to the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of flies in Australia. And they used to talk about the Australian salute, that, you know, that people were just brushing flies away all the time. And people have probably forgotten now, but one of the reasons that there aren't so many flies around now is because CSIRO, through the Division of Entomology, had a program of going out into the world and finding these dung beetles, and then they'd go into a quarantine process and they'd be tested for, you know, for any other impacts and adverse reactions that they might, adverse consequences they might lead to, and then selected for the various climatic regions. And so I was involved in that, not in the scientific part, but more in the organisation and administrative part of that.
Mm.
And so, and interesting enough, now where we live now, we note when the dung beetles come in, they come in at a particular time of year. Because we've had horses and that, you can tell when the dung beetles come in, and it's about November. So often we have, you know, a bit of a fly problem in late October.
Mm.
And then November, you start seeing the horse droppings and that all being chewed over by these dung beetles, and the flies go away.
Where did they get them from originally?
From a variety of different places. A lot of them, particularly the ones here in Western Australia, came from the south of France. So we had a station in the south of France. other ones from South Africa, and we also had a station in Brazil. So these things were introduced, and it was part of a concept of biological control. And there were some other aspects of that as well, that sort of that during that time. So that was a very interesting time. And then following that, by the time, by the late 70s, and we'd had two children, and one of the things about Canberra is it's very cold, and so the nappies would freeze on the line in the middle of winter. And so we
in
just
in the days of cloth nappies.
In the days of cloth nappies. And so we decided we'd like a move. And so that's when I moved back to Western Australia.
Right. It occurred to me when you were talking about wanting to organise the trajectory of your own life and not to go where the army sent you, and that for people who want to be independent and really do that, it would be quite difficult to adjust to being in the army. I guess the only way is up, really, so that you then become an absolute leader, because it's very hierarchical, isn't it, the whole...
It is. Most people who graduated from Duntroon would expect to get to the level of a major, and then it starts getting quite selective as you go higher, lieutenant, colonel, brigadier, and very few people get beyond that, if you like. In fact, the majority of people probably get to be a major.
And do majors have a certain amount of autonomy, or
they can do some. There are interesting roles for people. There's no question about that. But one of the aspects of that, as a major, you had to retire at 47.
Oh wow.
Which meant that you then had to find something else to do. Now, some people would go back and work for the Defence Department. Some people would go work for defence contractors and that sort of thing. And then as you went up, you retire at a later age. But one of my friends, it's funny because there was actually two of us doing physics. Out of all the group, there was two in the physics class, and he was the other one. And he got to be a brigadier, and I caught up with him in later years because the company I was working for was selling to the military, and he happened to be the person. And he'd married a little later in life. And at age 52, he still had a 10-year-old. He was looking at forced retirement, if you like, at age 52.
Right.
And he didn't want to go and work for the Defence Department or for a military contractor or whatever. And so he was quite concerned about what he might do after that.
Mm. So was it a retirement with a pension, or...?
Oh, yeah, retirement with a pension, because you pay into what was called the Defence Forces Retirement Benefit Fund right from the beginning, and so there was quite a decent pension, but of course people at that age
still want to do something.
I noticed quite a lot of people, because I used to get sort of newsletters and things, I noticed that quite a lot of people would end up perhaps being a bursar at a school or something like that. Often they'd go into logistics, because obviously organising things was something that they were good at.
So organisational skills is a key component of officer training, is it?
And the experience of being an officer, I guess. Like all big organisations, I found this in the corporate world, that some people don't translate well from large organisations to smaller organisations, because in large organisations, there are all sorts of things that are done that you don't even notice, from how materials are supplied to buildings and furniture and all of these sorts of things. In a small organisation, you have to do all that yourself. So some people who might have been in a senior position in a large organisation and had all sorts of invisible people doing things for them, when they go into a smaller company or a smaller organisation, don't adapt very well. Other people do adapt well and bring that experience and that broader set of knowledge and skills to a different organisation.
Yeah. Do you think the military's changed a lot over the years?
I'm sure it has.
I suppose you're seeing it from an outsider's point of view these days.
Yeah. There are some odd aspects. One of my friends that I keep in contact with was actually Oh, actually, one of his sons has gone through Duntroon and is in the military. Of course, one of our sons went into the military as well, as a tradesman. But meeting up with him recently, his son had been posted to Egypt, and my friend got very involved in sort of international relationships and things through the UN from a military perspective. And so his experience was lots of international type postings, but also when he retired, or in fact was made to retire as a major general, he's been called into work with the United Nations in a range of different roles. One of those, for example, he went in after Colonel Gaddafi was outed in Libya. He went in as part of the United Nations teams to try and set up the security apparatus for Libya, if you like, which is, you know, police forces and all of those sorts of things. And also recently he was he went into Yemen to work with the UN there. I guess the military is more complex than you might think. It's also part of international diplomacy, and you have people in the military who are operating through the UN, and they're part of the country's diplomatic apparatus, if you like.
In what way?
Well, if you like, at a high level, the government may decide that it's going to be involved in some international activity in which the military's involved. You know, it could be something as simple, for example, as aid to a South Pacific nation following some sort of natural disaster.
Mm.
But at the level below the minister, if you like, who makes the announcement and gets on the TV, there are people who have to implement that.
Who actually go in and do that.
Who actually have to do that. And so they have to negotiate their operating arrangements with the country or the organisation that they're involved in. And if it's a United Nations thing where there are multiple nations and things involved, then there are people in the military who have to negotiate with their peers in the other organisations as to how they're going to do that, how they're actually going to operate.
Complicated.
Yeah, like lots of things, I guess. If you look below the surface, there's much more going on.
A lot going on.
Than appears on the surface.
Yeah.
You're listening to an Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest, Stuart, has been discussing his time in the Military College of Duntroon. Now he goes on to speak of his time after leaving the services and returning to his home city of Perth.
Again, I was fortunate enough to be recruited from Canberra into a role with what was then the State Energy Commission of WA, which those days included power generation, transmission, distribution, and also gas, the gas system, and also energy safety and energy policy. Those things are now all separate sort of organisations.
Yep. Mm.
But I worked in that area for about 10 years, and I was fortunate enough to have a number of different roles there, including at the level of policy development and so forth. And planning and strategic planning and those sorts of things.
Mm.
So that was that went very well, and during that time we had our third child, and the kids started to grow up, and then I was again fortunate enough to get a position with a company which was a spin out from the University of WA. Again, getting back into the sort of internet-y type things.
Mm.
And what we developed there was high-speed networks. Again, before people were aware of the internet, there were still systems where computers had to talk to each other.
Mm.
And so we developed a system which was, they called it a metropolitan area network, but it was actually a national network which was for high-speed communications between computers across the country. And we also... that became an international standard, and so in that role I travelled extensively internationally, and we set up relationships with large companies in Germany and France, and I spent quite a lot of time in America as well. So that was a very interesting period. And then more changes of ownership and so forth. I was involved in negotiating sales of companies and taking teams of people across into other companies and so forth. Mm. And then spent some time with Ericsson in Sweden, which was, again, nice and interesting. And then there was a big collapse in the telecommunications business in the early 2000s, the big tech crash, as they called it. And then with some colleagues that I'd worked with throughout all that time, we set up our own business. And essentially we do research and development of products for other clients, other parties. And we've been doing that for about 16 or 17 years.
Mm. So you've had a fairly interesting career trajectory. And do you think the 3 years at Duntroon that you did set you or gave you certain skills that maybe you wouldn't have got otherwise?
It was 4 years. Four years. From beginning of 68 to the end of 71.
71, right.
I think it helped me a lot in the early part of my career post-Duntroon. In some ways, I think that what I thought was that was the time when I did my growing up on somebody else's time, if you like. And so when I came out of there at the age of turned 21, just after I left Duntroon, I think I had a more mature approach to life than other 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
And so when I went to work for CSIRO, I did well there, because I think I applied myself more than perhaps other people did.
Of the same age.
And so in that sense I stood out, if you like. And so I think that did help. And I think all of life's experiences help, but for some reason or other I always seem to have been in positions of leadership. And whether that was something that, well, before I went to Duntroon, I was in that situation, and afterwards, and I've never really understood why. Certainly, there are smarter people than me, and there are people who I think have better qualities than I do, but for some reason or other, I seem to be the sort of person who kind of brings people together and organises them and things like that. Whether that was something that I learned at Duntroon, or whether that was something that I learned through all of life's experiences, I don't know.
Mm.
Actually, interesting enough, I think there's too much concentration on leaders. I think that what's more important is why people follow. Because everyone has their own issues and their own sort of desires and wishes and so forth. So why do people choose to be the follower rather than the leader? I think you have to respect the people who decide to put themselves in that position, because they're saying, okay, I will adapt to what this person is saying is the right direction.
Mm.
I mean, it's a transaction. They do that because they see some benefit in it for themselves.
Mm.
And I guess if you are a leader and if you screw up too often, then people won't see the benefit anymore.
Yeah, well, that's right. I suppose a leader is in quite a vulnerable position in a way, and it is very much dependent on whether people wish to follow and wish to, support that person in the leadership position. It's not necessarily as powerful as you tend to think. It's actually a position of service, isn't it, as much as anything?
Well, that's certainly the way I see it, is that there's a responsibility not to screw up for other people, because if you're in that situation, your other people's livelihoods and well-being depend on you not screwing up too much.
You need quite a bit of courage, I think, to be a good leader.
One thing we didn't cover, which I think is kind of interesting, is that at the period, from a kind of historical perspective, I suppose, at the period that that I went to Duntroon and it became affiliated with the University of New South Wales, it was one of the first sort of organisations to do that, because most organisations at the time, people were selected into the organisation and trained by the organisation, as my life partner, my wife was, and lots of people went into that sort of situation and then were trained and then got a qualification, if you like. But then gradually over the next few years, all of the colleges of advanced education and institutes of technology and so forth all became universities. And so people then, instead of going into an organisation and being trained and having a role in that organisation, would go to university and then look for a job afterwards.
Mm. So there's a bit of a break in...
That's right. There was a system that sort of worked. It had some attributes, like you had to have bonds and so forth. Mm. And one of the things that came out a few years later was that bonds became illegal or unenforceable, if you like. And so you now have that situation where people go to universities and end up with a hex debt.
So really you didn't have to pay your bond back?
I did have to pay my bond back, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it was substantial. Because I resigned, if I'd failed or got my girlfriend pregnant, I wouldn't have had to do that. But because I went through this process of resigning, I had to pay the bond back. And so when I left Duntroon, I had no money and I had a debt. And the debt was, well, notionally it was my father's debt, but my mum and dad couldn't afford that. So I paid that back in instalments. But it was equivalent to about a half a year's salary at that time. So it was quite
huge.
Substantial. Yeah.
Yes.
And only a fraction of what it really cost to educate me, but it's, you know, significant for the individual, yeah.
That's right. So, the hex is certainly an improvement on that.
I think so, yeah. I think and when I went to ANU, I had to pay fees there as well. So I had to pay those in advance, of course. So I think hex is actually quite a good system, albeit that nobody likes the fact that you've got to pay this back for some of the cost of educating you.
Mm. I suppose it gets paid back once you're earning over a certain amount.
That's right, yeah. So you don't
start taking it out until...
Yeah, so it's not... it is conditional on you earning a certain amount of money, whereas with the bond system and so forth and with, you know, paying your fees up front, there was no way out, if you like. You had to pay it.
This is the end of part two. I hope you have found today's interview as interesting and worthwhile as I have. Thanks to Stuart for sharing his recollections and insights for this episode. A link is included on the homepage to areas where information can be found in relation to the issues raised. And thank you for listening.